Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 21st, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Stephen Wertheim, senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and visiting faculty fellow, the Center for Global Legal Challenges at Yale Law School. Also on the program today, Representative Ilhan Omar, Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. And also on the program today, David Feldman of... Meanwhile, U.S.-Russia talks over Ukraine progress, maybe. January 6th committee wants testimony from Ivanka Trump as they hear testimony of Trump's pre-January 6th secret meetings. Biden urged by congressional Democrats to overhaul our 20-year counterterrorism program after a report of massive civilian deaths, up to 48,000 over those past two decades. Meanwhile, the FBI raids conservative Dem Henry Cuellar's home. Incidentally, his primary is 5 weeks from now. Go support Jessica Cisneros right now. Meanwhile, Omicron hospitalizations peak in some places of the U.S., but not in all. It is one day before the 49th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and the Supreme Court refuses to speed a challenge to the Texas abortion ban. Intel to build a $20 billion semiconductor facility in Ohio. And single payer clears California Assembly Appropriations Committee. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. It is Casual Friday. You will note that I am wearing a soft-collared shirt. Emma Vigeland is here wearing really a no-collar type of situation.
Yeah, that usually is my situation. Maybe I'll, in order to just buck the orthodoxy, I will come in with a collared shirt next Friday.
All right. $80.
Yeah. Right.
Fair enough.
Many poloed shirts,
giant
layered.
Lapel.
3 to 4 polo shirts layered, collar popped on each one.
Oh, the Bannon.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that look. That was very big back in the 80s. That's good to hear.
And certain pockets of preppy New Jersey was still all the rage when I was growing up. So I might have some in my closet.
We got a lot to get to today, so let's get right into this clip, which I think really in many respects sums up just all the facets of where we are right now. It is MSNBC's Joe Scarborough interviewing Ron Klain, and this is one of those occasions where both sides of the conversation I find, not equally frustrating. But both deserve a lot of criticism. Play this clip.
Moderation is selling in the Democratic Party. So why is it that it seems time and time again the president has overreached, moved too far left, and has not been able to bring those final two senators home?
Well, first of all, I think the president is right in the middle of where the country is. You look at what's in our Build Back Better plan. bringing down the cost of childcare. I think that's a very moderate thing for families. Reducing the cost of prescription drugs, saying you shouldn't have to pay more than $35 for insulin. I think that's an all-American mainstream proposal.
All right. Let's just start with Joe Scarborough. Joe Biden has not moved left. There has not been a step towards the left that Joe Biden has taken over the course of his entire administration. He is to the right of everything that he outlined during his campaign when he won the presidency. When Joe Scarborough was saying people should vote for Joe Biden, every single thing that Joe Biden had proposed, he has rolled back on. It doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter if it's an executive action. Doesn't matter if it's a legislative proposal. Doesn't matter what it is. He has moved to the right on every one of his positions. So Joe Scarborough is just sort of building a narrative that is ludicrous. Meanwhile, Ron Klain, when you are trying to justify childcare for every American, you don't say childcare for every American is moderate. Who wants that?
Well, I mean, don't you think that Donald Trump woke up every morning and when he was advocating for his proposals, he was like, how
moderation.
Can I?
Right. When I said all Mexicans are rapists, I'm planting my flag right in the middle of where the American people are. Some say they're not. Some say they're worse than rapists. They're killers.
Wait, I mean, can you like just play that clip of Ron Klain? This the Ron Klain part of it. The reason why you propose childcare for every American is because it is an extremely urgent need by these parents. It's not because it's moderate. I mean, this is
First of all, I think the president.
Go ahead.
First of all, I think the president is right in the middle of where the country is. You look at what's in our Build Back Better plan, bringing down the cost of childcare. I think that's a very moderate thing for families. Reducing the cost of prescription drugs.
This guy is the chief, he is the chief of staff. They have put him out there to sell the president's accomplishments and proposals. And you're telling the American public, we have been out there. We have dealt with all of your moderate needs.
Yeah.
The mentality in the White House and in the establishment of the Democratic Party. And I genuinely believe that Joe Biden wanted to provide childcare in the, I think he genuinely thought that should happen. And their inability to wrap their heads around the idea that you need to sell this to the American public and explain to them why they should be upset that someone's not giving them the thing that we're offering. It's not because what we're offering you is something really moderate. It is because these people desperately need it, really want it. It's an extreme need by the American public. This is just like, these are supposedly the professionals.
And Ron Klain's one of the better people in the administration too. And even he is coming out and saying, you know, this is a moderate need for families. You know, that's like that, that really is so many of the Biden administration's and that kind of Democrats' perception of what a regular American family really votes on is if the need provided for them or if the social program that is being proposed or passed is right in the middle of the political spectrum as opposed to affecting their material needs.
They are so enthralled by the frame that's imposed upon them that they lose sight of exactly what they're doing. And I mean, and frankly, it was the problem from the very beginning in the way that they sold this Build Back Better. Nobody could complain about what they didn't get because your vast majority of Americans don't even know about it. I mean, you look at the polling today. Do you want President Biden to pass the Build Back Better? 32%. Of the population are like, yes. Yet, I mean, if they looked at every single proposal in there, they'd overwhelmingly support it. But the administration just done a really poor job of selling what they were trying to say.
If you're going to name something Build Back Better and not have it be directly connected to the policies that are in it, then you better go out and sell what those policies are, as you're saying. And they haven't done crap about
it. We can assure you it's moderate, so allow us to pass it. Meanwhile, got one sponsor for the program today. That is my favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Now, usually you'll notice Left is Best will get you 20% off of all their products. But right now, Sunset Lake CBD is releasing new flavored tinctures. The 750, the 1500, the 3000 milligram tinctures we all know and love will be available now in mint and citrus. If you enjoy their natural unflavored tinctures, don't worry. Those are still available. Those, I have to say, I really, really like the natural, but I have been getting into the mint. When I go to bed, people know I hit these tinctures hard for sleeping purposes. And the mint, I'm really loving because it doesn't conflict with my toothpaste. I don't know if that's why they did it, but check them out, folks. And this is the other exciting thing for me, anyways. They have a 6,000 milligram full spectrum tincture. It is made with purified CBD distillate. The 6,000 milligram tincture, it's the most powerful product Sunset Lake CBD has ever produced. A single dropper holds 100 milligram of CBD. So check it out, folks. It's great. I don't have to dip that thing twice when I know I'm not going to sleep. I can tell before I go to bed. Like I'm too riled up. Anyways, this started 2 or 3 days ago. All CBD tinctures will be 30% off. Orders over $100 will receive a free 750 milligram tincture, a $30 value for free. You don't need any promo code at checkout. All the products will be automatically discounted at checkout. So visit SunsetLakeCBD.com. Try these amazing new products right now. Take advantage of the sale while it lasts. It ends in 3 days. No, 4 days on January 25th. So check it out, folks. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Okay, I want to welcome back to the program, Stephen Wertheim, Senior Fellow at the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Visiting Faculty Fellow at the Center for Global and Legal Challenges at Yale Law School. Stephen, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Good to be back with you.
So it sort of feels like over the past week that we are slowly inching up to the precipice of a possible war with Russia. It's not getting really the attention that you would imagine something like that would and should, in my estimation. Let's just start before you give your analysis as to why we're at this point. Like, where are we? Like, give us a sense of what's happening to the extent that you're aware of on the ground.
Well, Russia has built up its military forces around Ukraine, first to the east. It has forces to the south that annexed Crimea in 2014, taking it from Ukraine. And it's also now conducting military exercises with Belarus from the north, putting its forces within striking distance of Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. So we're in a time-limited situation because Russia cannot maintain this kind of buildup indefinitely, and it's also better to invade in the winter and so forth. But what's happening right now is a diplomatic standoff. Just today, Secretary of State Tony Blinken met with his counterpart, the foreign minister of Russia, to discuss the two sides' mutual concerns. You know, there was a round of negotiations last week. None of this is looking like the two parties are very close, but the United States says that it will deliver, at Russia's request, a written response to Russia's demands next week. And we'll see if that's the end of the line, and likely Russia would take some sort of military action in Ukraine if it doesn't get what it wants, or if the negotiations have some chance of succeeding.
I have a sense I know what at least the main thing supposedly that Russia wants, and that deals with NATO. And let's get to that in a moment. But is there anything else? Like, how much is the Nord? Is it the Nord Stream pipeline? How much of this is it possible that this is a negotiation tool for something that is different than what is right at stake?
I do think that Ukraine matters a great deal to Russia, and that is definitely part of Russia's concerns here. Actually, what they're doing is putting in jeopardy the completion of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, by which Russia hopes to double the amount of natural gas that it descends into Europe, bypassing a pipeline in Ukraine. That pipeline would go right to Germany. It's, I think, quite possible that if Russia launches a new military offensive in Ukraine, that would scuttle the nearly completed Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So that's interesting. There's a real price that Russia seems to be willing to pay here. But I think you're right. I think that for Russian President Vladimir Putin, this creating this crisis is a way of registering Russia's intense concerns with the overall European security architecture. This goes back to the end of the Cold War, when Russia was excluded from European security matters. NATO ended up expanding dramatically in a number of rounds between 1997 and just a few years ago. And it really left Russia on the sidelines of European security matters, and even worse, from its point of view, facing an alliance that had always been aimed at the Soviet Union, facing itself. And so I think part of what's going on is a kind of general way for Russia to see what it might be able to obtain to make this situation better. For Vladimir Putin, he's actually presided over several rounds of NATO expansion. And frankly, I think some of his intervention in Ukraine has backfired from 2014. He hasn't gotten more leverage over the course of Ukraine's politics. So there also might be a legacy issue for him too, thinking, you know, how am I going to be remembered if Russia's security environment has actually deteriorated under his long tenure?
What are supposedly our interests in Ukraine? I mean, and aside from, I mean, I appreciate the idea that we have a certain amount of power in the world, and we want people not to, to live as freely as they can and whatnot. But I also am of the mind that that goodwill should stop before it involves us in a war at this point. But what are supposedly, for those people who are hawks in this situation, what is supposedly our interest relative to Ukraine? And I know that also has some spillover to Taiwan, which gets to your piece in the Washington Post. But what are their supposed concerns or notion of our interest there?
Not many hawks even would say that the United States has intrinsic interests in Ukraine that would justify war. And I want to be clear, there aren't many Americans calling for war with Russia over Ukraine. And the Biden administration has said that the use of force is, to quote the president, not in the cards. So he took the use of force seemingly off the table last month. And I think that's important. So hopefully the risk of a U.S.-Russia war here is not that high, although I have my moments wondering whether that's the case and trying to think about how this will play out if a really ugly act of aggression by Russia takes place and we have a Congress that's upset, so forth. So what are the main U.S. concerns? You know, the main sticking point for the Biden administration is the idea of NATO expansion. Russia has made pretty clear that it wants to prevent Ukraine from ever joining NATO. It's also said it doesn't really trust the word of the West, and it wants a formal agreement from NATO. Now, this is very unlikely to happen. But there's a principle that the United States and NATO have called the open door, by which countries can apply to join NATO. They can choose which alliances they would like to have. So this is a talking point that you see a lot among those who are quite critical of Russia's position here. And that's kind of true as far as it goes. But in fact, Ukraine is not about to join NATO. It's unfortunately in 2008, at the behest of George W. Bush, NATO issued a proclamation saying that Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, but at the same time refused to give those countries a plan to be admitted, what's called a membership action plan. So since then, you've had a lot of loose talk coming from officials in Washington, D.C. about how they'd like to see Ukraine in NATO, but we're not really serious about admitting Ukraine into NATO because that would cause a war with Russia. And we know that. And in fact, we understand that we don't have interests that would justify such a grave action as going to war with a great power and a nuclear peer. So there's this kind of game going on. And so what I find really odd is that it seems like the thing that's hardest for officials in Washington to say is that, yes, we don't want to see Ukraine in NATO. Whereas the Biden administration has seemed to be more willing to negotiate over some other issues that Russia has raised, like the issue of missiles placed in Eastern Europe, where there potentially could be an agreement.
Is that reflective of an already existing split in NATO when it comes to Ukraine? Because we're seeing that Germany is not on board with the United States fortifying Ukraine's border as Russia seems to be encroaching.
Yeah, you know, part of the legacy of NATO expansion over three decades is that NATO has a lot of members, and it has members with different interests. So Germany and France have long been opposed to Ukraine's membership in NATO. Countries to the east, like Poland or the Baltic states, understandably, they are more concerned with the potential for Russia to launch invasions to Russia's west. And they're more willing to, you know, push NATO to do more to support Ukraine. The UK, interestingly, is also seemed to be more more hawkish at the moment. So there are splits in NATO, which President Biden acknowledged in his press conference, which for some reason caused a scandal, because I think the Kremlin understands that there are these longstanding divisions, as does everyone else. But the United States and the NATO allies were able to get agreement on imposing sanctions on Russia after Russia supported separatists in eastern Ukraine in 2014, after it also annexed the Crimean Peninsula. And, you know, it does seem as though if there is a large scale Russian invasion of Ukraine now, that there will be a lot of support for significant sanctions, although just how hard those will hit remains unclear.
Why are there people who want to maintain this sort of like vague fiction that we would admit? I mean, aside from the idea that I don't think that we should admit Ukraine into NATO, and frankly, I wouldn't mind disinviting all of our members of NATO. Maybe we have talked in the past about, you know, NATO may have outgrown its usefulness. But why is this fiction being maintained? Is it like some type of chit that somebody's just like holding on to, hoping to cash in at one point? And maybe, you know, I mean, your piece in the Washington Post argues that because this chit has been played so aggressively, the idea of admitting that it has created a certain amount of paranoia, which is not to say that Vladimir Putin is not necessarily paranoid with, you know, without it. But I mean, why would we include, Ukraine as part of NATO? And then we'll get on to the Taiwan thing. But why is this maintained? If everyone knows it's a fiction, why is this maintained? Why is this fiction maintained?
Well, I share your question and the frustration behind it. The optimistic version, which I don't think is likely, would be that the Biden administration is so far withholding a bit on what it might be willing to offer in the process of negotiation. So maybe we could see a different approach in the coming weeks. And President Biden was I think he spoke a little bit differently in his very long press conference the other day in emphasizing that what he said was that Ukraine will not become a NATO member in the near term. He talked about all the reasons why Ukraine wouldn't qualify, including its own corruption inside the government, not to mention the fact that all the members of NATO would have to agree to its admission. So the near term, if you're reading between the lines, sounded like a very long time, essentially indefinitely. But the more pessimistic and I think likely reading of this is that, for one thing, Russia is building itself up to undertake an act of aggression. This is not the kind of thing that we like to see. That is understandable. And there would be a domestic political price here for either NATO or the United States to be seen to be making concessions in the face of Russian threats. So that's a problem. I also think perhaps on another level, for a set of policymakers who have expanded NATO over the last several decades, they've defined success in terms of the enlargement Right. of NATO and the enlargement of American power and of the liberal capitalist democratic sphere of the world. It's kind of an admission of failure to say this project has come to an end. NATO's open door is effectively closed. Perhaps it will never be reopened. And in fact, even the fact that the initial dream in the 1990s was that the United States and NATO could expand without antagonizing Russia too badly. And initially, there were even hopes maybe Russia one day will join NATO. And what should have been evident, I'm afraid, at the time, and was to some people, was that this was never going to happen. There was a real trade-off here. And so at least those dreams have come to a point of clear failure.
I mean, it feels like you could also just redefine it as success. Now we're done. Now we move into another stage of world history. Let's just turn to Taiwan, because some people are saying there are some arguments that if we are not strong in the face of a Russian incursion into Ukraine, that somehow this will signal to the Chinese that the U.S. doesn't have what it takes to protect Taiwan. But your argument in the Post is our over-aggressiveness about Ukraine into NATO has been the fundamental reason why there is this aggression from Russia, and that the lesson in terms of Taiwan is simply to do what we've been doing with Taiwan, which is to try and find a place where everybody's comfortable.
Yeah, we've understood for some time where the red lines were for Russia and for China. We have constructed a delicate one China policy and a stance of strategic ambiguity vis-a-vis Taiwan, where we nominally will allow there to be peaceful reunification of China. We recognize only one China, as does the mainland, but we don't really specify which one is the one that should be eventually in control of Taipei or Beijing. And this is an artful compromise. Now, the situation in Ukraine's quite different. I think the issue there, we don't have even an ambiguous security commitment toward Ukraine. We simply do not have one there. But it has, I think, been pretty well appreciated over the years that a red line for Russia would occur if Ukraine became exclusively aligned with the West for security as well as economics and so forth. Russia views Ukraine and other countries that were former Soviet republics as part of its privileged zone of interest, as Boris Yeltsin said back in 1995. And so we've kind of danced around this issue through that declaration that George W. Bush pushed to, you know, say that Ukraine would join NATO, and then by refusing to backtrack and correct our mistake. And I think playing this game hasn't helped. Would Russia potentially have launched aggression against Ukraine anyway? It's possible. But, you know, these measures, I think, have not helped. They may well have been necessary causes of the crisis that got us to this point. And there's certainly steps that have been unwise for the United States, because it has made us a major player, a major party in this dispute, when had we taken a different course, we wouldn't have to be.
Do you think that domestic pressures are, I mean, you said that there's maybe some domestic price to be paid politically if Russia is seen to, you know, has some type of incursion into Ukraine. But is that the case anymore? I mean, I don't see any evidence that the American public is terribly invested in our protection of Ukraine. I get that on the, you know, it's sort of the margins of the party, and there's some of the neocons, and the, you know, there are, but is that a thing anymore?
You raise a very good point. I know that officials are concerned about this. And I know that you can see members of Congress making statements to look as tough as they can on Russia, although none of them really, I think, are calling for war. So they're kind of tiptoeing around it, which is not particularly responsible. And I think the administration it's a cautious administration in general, and maybe especially on foreign policy. And, you know, the Afghanistan withdrawal didn't help matters. I don't think that Biden's popularity has fallen because of the Afghanistan withdrawal, but his drop in ratings did coincide with that period. Now, I think it probably had more to do with the spike in Delta than, in other words, conditions at home, than actually a policy that was popular, which was ending the war in Afghanistan.
Right.
But I think that has contributed to this caution within the administration. And, you know, to get back to your other question, I think it's precisely because there's not a whole lot of there's not many Americans who would like to fight Russia over Ukraine, that there's kind of a search to make other arguments that might resonate more. Like, imagine that if the United States were to show weakness over Ukraine, then Xi Jinping in Beijing would see this as a signal that he could invade Taiwan easily. If anything, I think it'd be the opposite. I think that China would think
we're not going to fight two wars at the same time.
No, this is not a winning situation for us. I think it would actually, the thing that could actually change calculations potentially in Beijing would be if we really escalated in Ukraine.
Right. I mean, keep your powder dry it's an idiom. I didn't make that up. All right. So lastly, let me just add, what do you think is going to happen? Final question. What do you think is going to happen from here on in now?
Well, I'm pessimistic that diplomacy will succeed. I suspect the parties are too far apart. And it just doesn't look like, in particular, the issue of NATO expansion, which Russia wants officially, formally foreclosed is going to be something that the United States and its NATO allies will entertain. So I suspect that Russia will undertake a significant military offensive in Ukraine. Exactly what form that will take, I don't know. It could take a number of forms. But as Biden alluded to, you know, at this point, Vladimir Putin has staked so much credibility, coercive credibility here, as he's ramped up, that for him to do nothing would, I think, probably not be realistic. Maybe, you know, he's such a liar, he could just say, oh, I never intended to do this. That would be a nice quality to display. I'd be happy, but I doubt that's going to happen. So he may try to seize more of Ukraine. He may try to take over parts of the east where Russia had already been backing pro-Russian separatists. There may be strikes on Kiev in an attempt to topple the government. And that is something I know that right now Americans aren't paying very close attention to this issue. You know, Novak Djokovic, whether he'd be booted from Australia, got a lot of attention in the news, et cetera. But I think, you know, once we see this government really under attack from Russia, that is going to cause Americans to pay attention. It's going to cause Congress to pay attention. And although, again, there's not an appetite for war with Russia over this, you know, I think I'll be looking to see that those who are rightly standing against Russian aggression are also emphasizing the limits of what the United States ought to do in this circumstance. If it's all this one-dimensional, we've got to stop Russia talk that's loose, I start to worry about the momentum that that our politics will exert in the crisis.
All right. Well, hopefully we can check back in with you in maybe a week or two, get a sense of where we're at with that. Stephen Wertheim, senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and visiting faculty fellow at the Center for Global Legal Challenges at Yale Law School. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Now, want to welcome back to the program Representative Ilhan Omar, Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, also the whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Congresswoman, welcome back. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing well. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. I want to ask about a broad question about whether Joe Biden's legislative agenda is over. But before we do, Emma, why don't you just start off with more specifics about what people are talking about in the wake of the Build Back Better non-happening, I guess.
Yeah, it's good to see you, Representative Omar, and thanks for coming on. There's been an increasingly loud drumbeat, it seems to me, and including President Biden publicly saying so the other day, that Build Back Better may need to be broken up into separate pieces, and there should be an attempt to pass those pieces separately. To me, that seems like a fool's errand, because you still then have to get past the filibuster in the Senate, and no Republican is going to vote for even the smaller pieces of Build Back Better. And then there's also talks, okay, let's make Build Back Better just the climate bill and get that through reconciliation. I have my doubts about that as well, but given this developing story, I'm curious what your position is on breaking up legislation, even though there's only really one bite at the apple left through the reconciliation process.
Well, thank you all for having me. And Emma, it sounds like the fool's errand that you are referencing was also referenced by Pelosi herself, who said anybody who's talking about breaking this up and thinking it'll get through doesn't know how legislative processes work. And I think that you are right. It is going to not be possible if we are not putting a package together through reconciliation to bypass you know, the parliamentarian and the procedural hurdles that we've already seen take place in the Senate.
So I guess then, I mean, that opens the door to the question. I mean, is Joe Biden's legislative agenda done? I mean, we'll find out what happens in 2022. But I think there's reason to believe that Democrats won't retain both houses at the least. But at least until 2022, is this basically the end of the legislative agenda?
I know that there are a lot of people who would like to see the agenda be over, for us to abandon the promises that we've made to the American people. But the majority of us in Congress, not just progressives, but I think majority of Democrats are interested in pursuing this agenda as aggressively as possible. There are a lot of options. You know, as you remember, there was a framework that was initially put together that the White House said was agreed upon by Manchin and Sinema, and then Democrats in the House decided to mess with it a little bit, which I suppose upset Manchin. And, you know, there's still options, I think, for us to pursue this agenda.
What are those options? I mean, is that framework, or is it basically just like we see what President Manchin wants to suggest, and then people follow suit?
Don't give him that credit. He's not president. He won't become president. But I do think that there is a path that's being talked about where, you know, we put together a reconciliation piece that has climate provisions, that has childcare, some form of getting the child tax credit extended. So those conversations are still happening. I know that free college is also being talked about as being supported right now. So there's still a lot of conversations that are taking place. I don't know what the, you know, ultimate package would look like. These days, everything is sort of hodgepodge in some ways, but I'm optimistic that something will be put together in the next couple of months.
But based on the Manchin's, I guess, touchiness, right? If the House decides to mess with it a little bit, then he backs away. Is the best approach just basically saying, okay, the ball's in your court, and then bring it back to us in the House, and then we'll send it through? Because everything seems to stop with him in terms of these negotiations.
I do think giving him a crack at it, a first take, might actually be strategically possible. I think, you know, Speaker Pelosi was alluding to this. I think the challenge of letting him draft something is that, you know, you might not be able to get a majority of us in the House to vote for it. So there is a delicate dance that needs to take place. And, you know, we're all committed to this as legislators to continue to do that dance so that we can deliver for our constituents. But what I will say, you know, is that the Freedom to Vote Act is actually a Manchin legislation. And so, you know, nothing says that if we allow for him to produce legislation, that if there are no procedural hurdles, that, you know, that it's not to pass.
I mean, we should say, though, I mean, in the event of a, you know, some hodgepodge of, you know, a Frankenstein version of Build Back Better, theoretically, the procedural hurdles are already dealt with, because that would go through reconciliation. You wouldn't need to create a carve out. Like,
and that's what I was saying. I think we cannot go down the path of saying, let's have, you know, singular pieces of legislation move, because we know they will run into procedural hurdles. So for me, it's easier to commit to and go along with a process where we are putting some pieces together through reconciliation, because then we know that at least they will get passed.
Do you think, looking back, and we should say there were six of you Democrats who did not vote for the BIF, the bipartisan, the Sinema-Portman bipartisan infrastructure deal. And at the time, it was because you were saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that if we pass this, it's going to give Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema the room to stand in the way of Build Back Better. And there were obviously members in the Democratic caucus who didn't agree. I imagine there was also some dissent within the Progressive caucus because Jayapal voted for it, and there was no whipping of the Progressive caucus to vote against it, is my assumption. I don't know. You would know better. But it would appear that your votes against that bill were the correct vote, at least in terms of maintaining some leverage.
It appears so. I think, you know, many of us would like to not be here today, having proven right. And, you know, I will say that, you know, in those conversations, many of us were very forceful in trying to tell our colleagues that if we did go down the path of submitting to the demands of Manchin without our own demands, that we will ultimately end up empty-handed. And, you know, unfortunately, that's sort of where we are at the moment.
Is there any understanding that you were proven right? Have your colleagues said to the six of you that this, we were wrong, you were right, and now Build Back Better may be dead because we caved on this?
Emma, you must not spend a lot of time with politicians.
I guess not. Right?
those are not words I think politicians are used to say. I was wrong, you were right. Is something that a lot of my colleagues are not really comfortable with saying.
But
you know, it is the unspoken truth in our caucus.
But do you think that there were? I mean, is it the case, and I understand that you guys don't all like hang out at the commissary, and it's not high school, and you're not, you know, like, you know, people aren't, you know, talking in gym class about, well, you know, what you thought about this. So you may not have, but is it not the case that for a lot of the members of Congress, that the idea was, okay, yeah, we knew we were giving up our leverage, but we wanted to be able to say that we passed it. Like, in other words, it's one thing to say we didn't exercise our leverage on the senators. And it's another thing to say, like, we did our job, and that there is a sufficient number of people in Congress who think it was enough to say we did our job. And as if that's going to be in any way meaningful to a single voter out there. We did our very narrow job here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways, you know, the we did our job narrative for us in a way makes sense because we are separate houses, right? We're in the House of Representatives, they're in the Senate. We can only control what happens in our own house. So I, you know, that you're right, Sam. Like, there's a lot of people who are comfortable with just singularly saying that. The problem here is that this is not a divided house. We don't have, you know, the House being led by a particular party and the Senate being led by another party, you know, the administration being different. This is our agenda, right? The agenda that we are advocating for and the agenda that we are wanting to pass to the American people is one agenda, right? It's the Democratic agenda. And the Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House. So this idea that, you know, people will just believe us when we say we did our part is a hard sell in this scenario. In other scenarios, in you know, in the previous year, we could pass pieces of legislation out of the House and say, you know, we did our part. And I don't think that there was a lot of thought that went into thinking it through.
Well, I mean, okay, I want to just put a pin in that in terms of like whose responsibility it was to do that thought, because obviously there were six of you who could think of that, and you were, you know, freshman and sophomore congresspeople. So it's not like you had the benefit of decades of experience to see where this was going. So I want to put a pin in that for a second, but just ask this question. Is it your sense that had you not passed, had you as a sophomore congressperson been able to convince the entire caucus to withhold their vote, then it wouldn't have gotten onto the floor at that point, and it would have been delayed so that the original agreement of this is all going to pass together was fulfilled? Would you have lost like the Gottheimers, like the so-called, you know, the corporatists who are very interested in the tax cuts or whatever it is that they want? Would you have lost them? I mean, in other words, was there a compelling argument on the other side of like, hey, you know, this is not just about, it's not enough that we pass this. We need to exercise our leverage. Everybody can see where this is going. Would you have lost them permanently in some way? Like if you'd come back 3 months later and voted for both bills, would Gottheimer say, look, well, no, we wanted it to pass 3 months ago, so we're not going to vote for that bill today?
I don't think so. I think that there was no way in my mind, and we continue to make this case, to lose votes on Build Back Better. That is an agenda that is supported by, you know, most of our constituents. It is the one piece of legislation that would touch people's lives. You know, roads and bridges are important, but you have to be going somewhere. You need to go to work. You need to have, you know, resources for childcare. There's all the other things that you need in order for the roads and bridges investments to make sense in your life, were tied up in the Build Back Better agenda. And so I couldn't see anybody voting no on that. But you have to, you know, sort of look at the way in which the conversation was being shaped, right? Like there was a lot of people, and I would say naively, because we seem to not learn, that were saying, you know, we need this win. This is, you know, this is what's going to be in the headlines. People are going to talk about it. Our constituents are going to be happy that, you know, we're working the president's agenda with the infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure bill passing is just going to dominate the headlines. And we were like, we don't think so. That's not what's going to happen. Everybody's going to keep asking about what happened to the rest of the agenda. And that's where we are right now. Nobody's talking to us about the bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed. That win is something that, you know, the administration, ourselves, everybody wants to say there was a win, but nobody is interested in that win. Everybody is talking to us about the failure of not being able to get Build Back Better passed. And you know, we would have avoided, I think, that the kind of tragedy that we're living through right now if we would have continued to have the hard conversations that were necessary in order for us to exercise our leverage.
Is this just really a matter of just like sort of incompetence in leadership? I think the point you're making that when we control both houses, that one would anticipate or expect that there's some type of coordination, that maybe Chuck Schumer would say, hey, you know, I don't have these two. They're not on board yet. In fact, I had a secret document that I signed in July that suggested to me that. And Nancy, you really shouldn't pass this yet, because if you do that, I lose my leverage. I mean, do you think is it possible that they don't have that awareness? Or is it just that they think it will be sufficient to get, they thought that like if we pass this bipartisan highway bill, essentially, it's, you know, people are going to hail us as the second coming and no one's going to even notice. I mean, what is it, incompetence, or is it that just they're not engaged in the agenda?
I think the disinterest in, you know, the support that these pieces of legislation have with the public from Manchin and Sinema, I think is something that many people in Congress and probably in the administration underestimate. You know, there is a lot of conversations that, you know, people have in Washington where the agenda is really driven by, you know, public sentiment, what the media is saying, you know, what the pundits are pushing for, and you don't want, you know, the onslaught of negative headlines talking about your agenda and your unwillingness to get something done, and so most people are willing to do what they can to avoid that. And the fact that Sinema and Manchin thrive on that because it pays dividend with their donors is truly not something I think that leadership thought about or is willing to acknowledge.
What percentage would you say, if you were to divide the conversation between public perception and backlash and getting us a win versus substance of the legislation and what we are providing for the American people, where is that dividing line in Congress in terms of how representatives are putting that in the forefront of what they're talking about when they're legislating? 50-50, you know, 80-20. I mean, because to me, that would be my primary frustration if I were you, that the substance seems to take a backseat to how is this going to look in the media? How is this going to look in terms of giving us a win versus a loss?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on, you know, individual members, but I would say collectively, if you were thinking of as a part, as a body, the headlines usually do drive the importance of things in Washington.
All right. So last question, and it's sort of inspired on some level by what we've talked about in terms of the strategy around the BIF and the Build Back Better, and a piece that was in The Intercept about Amani Badhaso, who is a who is challenging a congressperson from the congresswoman 21-year tenure in Congress, Betsy McCollum from Minnesota, who has been, claims progressive bona fides. I think in this article, she actually states that she voted for the BIF, which, you know, placed her in some type of more progressive because you had voted against that agenda, which I thought was a little silly. But there was a quote from Badhaso that was something to the effect of, here in the progressive movement, we have to think about what Democrat actually means beyond just who votes along a certain line. Frankly, we need leadership that just gives a damn about folks in the community. I think that a little bit speaks to what the cues are for people in Congress. But in terms of leadership, Nancy Pelosi had made a pledge that she was not going to retain leadership if, passed this term, if I remember correctly. I don't know if she intends to maintain that pledge. And I don't know if it will be as Speaker of the House come 2022. But at one point, people are going to have to retire, I think. It is stunning, frankly.
I like where this is going.
Well, I mean, what is going on in terms of, like, planning for the leadership fight that is coming? And it is going to be a big fight. And where do you have a sense of who the progressive candidate for leadership, or what the strategy is, or any of that?
Oh, good God. There are a lot of candidates. I think people are making the rounds. I refuse to take phone calls from people who want to talk about leadership for a term that many of us don't even know what will ultimately happen, who will come back and who won't, and whether we will be in the majority or in the minority. And, you know, I think strategically things shift when you're in the minority, having served in the Minnesota House in the minority. So I couldn't tell you what the pitch has been from people, because I have not answered the calls from.
Well, I'm more interested in, like, not so much the pitch that you're getting, but the agenda. I mean, surely there must be talk amongst the progressive caucus or against the squad, amongst the squad, as to who you would prefer, or if, you know, generically, even generically speaking, but I imagine that there's some names associated with that generic vision of who would be the right type of leadership. Have you guys had those conversations? Do you have ideas? I mean, how much work is being done? Is there, I mean, I understand your reluctance to be too specific in this situation, but.
Yeah, but I want people to sort of, I know we get asked this question quite a lot, and I think that there's a lot of, like, emphasis on who the person is, what their, you know, progressive qualifications are, you know, who are you going to support? What are they going to prioritize? And I just want to remind people that almost everyone that is in leadership right now came to Congress as pretty progressive. And they, you know, were people who, again, like, our whole thing as Democrats is for the people agenda, right? Like, we are supposed to be advocating an agenda that is for the people. And many a times, you know, it seems like corporate donors get their way more than the people do. And so we cannot dilute ourselves with this delusion that, you know, people do not change the way they govern and what they prioritize when they get into a leadership position like the speakership or being the chair of the Democratic caucus or, you know, the chair of the DNC or the majority leader in the Senate. You know, if you think about Chuck Schumer, his voting record and the pieces of legislation that he sometimes puts on the floor that he himself votes against are not aligned. And so, you know, when you're talking about a holistic agenda and what will be pushed forward, sometimes it doesn't depend on the person that is in leadership. I think the leadership position does change you. And so I am not somebody who likes to get their heart broken, so I'm not gonna invest a lot of energy into thinking about, you know, what the person is today, because I know that people who are there right now who have shifted their position. And as the whip of the Progressive Caucus, I know that many of the chairs within the Democratic Caucus, many who have leadership positions either were founders of the Progressive Caucus or are still dues paying members of the Progressive Caucus. I whip them on questions on how they're going to vote. And I, you know, I'm constantly shocked. And it, I think to the American public, especially the progressive left, it's easy for us to want people who have, you know, integrity, people who have the courage to stand for their convictions, people who are principled. And in reality, that is just a small number of people who have those characteristics who ascend to leadership positions.
My fear, I guess, is just that it seems that someone like Hakeem Jeffries is set up to potentially succeed Pelosi in this instance, and I just
who's a member of the Progressive Caucus.
Absolutely, it's just it's and Barbara Lee was narrowly defeated by him for Dem Caucus chair, and it seemed like that was a bit more rushed. And so, is there any push, I guess, for the progressives to line up somebody and coalesce behind someone early to, at the very least, push whoever eventually becomes speaker to the left?
Yes, yes. I mean, obviously, that is our goal. You know, those of us who are progressives in Congress are not there to push people to the center or to the right. We are constantly doing everything that we can to move a progressive agenda. And, you know, we ultimately are creating pressure spots for people to do that.
Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, thank you so much for coming on today. I have still some more questions about that, but the leadership fight's a little bit ways away, so we can hopefully catch up with you again on that in the future.
Well, I'm always around to chat.
All right, appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, now we're going to bring on our headliner guest of the day. We've had a couple of people who have warmed up the crowd, as it were, and we're bringing our headlining guest.
This is like when Radiohead comes on Coachella after the opening bands.
Exactly. Ladies and gentlemen, David Feldman of the David Feldman Show.
Jesus.
Hello.
Hi.
Is we just getting a picture of you today? Is that what's happening?
You're doing a show today?
Yeah, we are. You're on the show.
I thought you were going to cancel.
Why would we cancel?
I guess you're going for that, you know, like after 9/11 when Letterman came back and Jon Stewart came. So you're going for this big, like, you know, you're going to use the show to be the empath in chief. Like, we're going to all suffer together. Is that what you're? I'm just surprised you did the show because I.
Are you good, David?
I'm not good, and I'm surprised you guys are doing a show and acting.
What are you talking about?
Meatloaf.
Meatloaf, the singer Meatloaf.
Meatloaf passed away last night, and
right.
Maybe I don't know. Maybe it's a generational thing. I know you guys might be a little younger than I am, but Meatloaf,
much. I think is
well.
I think it's really it's much.
I lost my virginity listening to Meatloaf.
Paradise by the
Dashboard. I don't think you did. I think
Paradise by the Dashboard Light. No,
you're confused. The song was about losing the virginity. You didn't lose the virginity.
No, not to the song. He stood over my bed and said, "Take your pants off."
Oh God!
Now kiss her. I listened
Is that
to
true.
Meatloaf stood over my bed and taught me how to deflower myself. And this is very upsetting. And it was unexpected. Did you know it was from COVID? You know, he died from COVID.
I did not know that.
You didn't. Well, case? So if you should we cancel the show? This is a tragedy. Look, he was against the mask mandate, big Trump supporter. And to learn that he died from COVID, this one hits hard and should serve as a wake-up call to all of us, because this is a man, 75 years old, you know, maybe 200 pounds overweight, not much. And it just, and he didn't get the vaccine, and it just reminds you of the randomness of COVID. It can kill anyone, even someone in his mid-70s who is 200 pounds, 300 pounds overweight and didn't get vaccinated. So it's
he probably should have gotten vaccinated.
I don't see. There you go. I don't want to politicize the death of that's what you do on this show. I get it, but it's not right at this time.
I don't think it's, I'm not making a political statement at all. Making a medical statement. There's a tremendous amount of evidence. Reports came out today.
Are you a doctor?
I'm not a doctor. No.
So how do you know? How do you know that Meatloaf didn't have was allergic to masks or shots? How do you know?
He might have been. I'm not.
There you go. So the man is dead, and you have that smirk on your face, like, oh, he didn't get vaccinated, and he's 75, and you know maybe he should have dropped 400 or 600 pounds, and he didn't take care. Like, it's his fault. Like, it's some kind of personal responsibility. Instead of using your show to remind everybody of the randomness of COVID, it can strike anyone. You never know who it's going to strike and who it's going to kill. And I just can't believe Meatloaf is dead. I just.
Well, listen, I'm sorry that you're taking this so hard. You know, 75 years is a decent run for a guy like Meatloaf. Literally run, but
God, I can't believe you're smiling. Fine. You know what?
I'm sorry. Listen, but my point about the vaccination is not whether Meatloaf was allergic to masks or the vaccination. I don't know that he was one way or another. But in general, we know from the CDC that people who have been vaccinated and particularly boosted are far, far less likely to be hospitalized and to die from this, well, from COVID in general, because it includes Omicron.
Okay. That's how you want to politicize.
What is political about that?
Because he did not believe in masks. He was a Trump supporter and he was against the vaccine mandates. When a man dies from COVID, you don't bring up the fact that he didn't get vaccinated. That politicizes the issue. And that's, you know,
David, I'm pretty sure you brought that up.
Well, I mean, we lost. Hey, I'm picking up. I'm pro science. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So. Okay.
So you were against science.
Well, yeah, it's implying that, like, I'm interested in this stuff, and there are other centers for disease control other than the monopolistic CDC that doesn't compete with any other organization.
You're for free market disease control.
Hold on a moment. You're saying there's multiple centers of disease control.
Well, it is plural. There's an S. It's the Centers for Disease Control, not the Center for Disease Control. How can we only hear from what?
I'm pretty sure it's the center.
No. See, you don't do your own research. It's the Centers for Disease Control. Did I win the argument?
Yeah, you win, David.
I see. Now, this is because I do my own research, and it's the Centers for Disease Control. But we only hear from how can we only hear from one center?
Well, I think it is. You're hearing from all the centers.
No, you're hearing from one center, not all the centers.
When the CDC says it, it's all the centers in that name.
Who do you hear? You hear that Dr. Walsh, whatever her name is, not anybody else.
Walensky?
Well, yes.
She's the head of the Centers for Disease Control.
So there's no other heads of why aren't there heads of the Centers for Disease Control?
Well, there may be heads of the specific centers, but the centers as an organ, as an agency, there's one leader of it.
All right, fine, whatever. I'm just saying we lost a Meatloaf today, and let's just use his death to remind everybody of the randomness of COVID.
What do you mean? Keep saying the randomness of COVID.
It can strike anybody, and that we should just, make the phone call, call the people you love, and remind them that you love them, because you never know when COVID is going to strike. If it could hit a 75-year-old man who, 2,000, 3,000 pounds overweight, didn't get vaccinated, doesn't wear a mask. If it can hit somebody like Meatloaf, it can hit any one of us. Hug your children. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, look, David, I agree that we are all susceptible, but the susceptibility can be mitigated. That's all I'm saying, by mask wearing and by vaccination and booster. You can't eliminate.
You're going to politicize his death. You're going to use his death now to do something really dirty.
How is it not? Let me ask you this. How is it not political for you to say it could strike anybody, but it is political for me to say it could strike anybody, but here's a way of minimizing your risk.
Because telling people to love one another isn't political. That's human decency. But to pass judgment on a man who at the age of 75, who was maybe 6 or 10,000 pounds overweight and didn't get vaccinated, you are politicizing that. Your life is random. And I'm I'm pro-vaccine. I got them all. So don't.
I don't doubt that for a moment.
I got the Moderna in my right arm, Pfizer in my left. I got the Johnson & Johnson in my butt, and I'm getting.
Sounds like a special request.
I don't get it.
Well, I just never heard of anybody getting any of these vaccinations in their butt.
Well, it's the scientific method. I do the Moderna in my right arm. I do the Pfizer in my left. I don't have another arm. I don't have another arm.
You know what the scientific method means. That is well, not yeah. So what the scientific method is.
If you get COVID in your ass, you know the Johnson & Johnson doesn't work as well as the other ones.
Right.
Oh, I guess, is that what you're doing? You're trying to find out if you can localize the COVID infection?
I feel like you guys are picking on me for being pro-science.
Did you get COVID in your ass, David?
Excuse me. We really need to talk.
Yeah.
About my balloon knot in front of, I mean, this is, it's like the afternoon, and this is, I thought this was a highbrow show. I came here, I'm a child of the Enlightenment, and literally. And so I can look at my left arm and see how the Pfizer is doing and the right arm to see how the Moderna is doing. And I squat over a mirror to see how Johnson and Johnson is doing. That's the scientific method, Sam. I'm pro.
Let me tell you how long I think it's going to take for me to get over that image.
Of what? Me looking at
of you squatting over a mirror. Like I think it's possible that I will see grandchildren before I can get that image out of my head.
I take a picture.
Right.
I squat over my mirror and we take a picture. My lady says, say cheese. And
in terms of
I smile.
How you're going to pucker or?
No, she takes a picture of my balloon knot. And, she says, say cheese. Can we I'm here to talk about a tragedy and the scientific.
Full circle, right? I mean, You at one point had meatloaf looking over you.
Oh my God! Is this what you're doing now on the show?
I don't know.
You're laughing. Laugh at the dead.
I'm not laughing. I'm not laughing.
You laugh at the dead. You laugh at the dead. The sudden death. We're all shocked. Meatloaf, 75 years old, unvaccinated. Maybe
several thousand,
14,000, 20,000 pounds overweight.
Right.
Suddenly dies from COVID, and you think it's funny. You politicize it the same way you politicized Martin Luther King's holiday, which I saw, and I've heard you talk about
that. How did you see me politicize? But first, what does that mean to politicize? Who was Martin Luther King?
Who was, first of all, Dr. Martin Luther King.
Who was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? Who was
Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King?
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Who was
the Reverend? The Reverend Dr.
Yes.
Martin.
Correct.
That was his wife. No, Coretta. Yeah. I'm sorry, I misheard. I was for the holiday, but.
What do you mean I didn't want a holiday.
I thought he should have had a holiday, but I said
why?
Because it's Dr. Martin Luther King, the Reverend Dr. And he deserves a holiday. And he's
why did he deserve a holiday?
Because he's a great American. And
what does that mean? He's a great American.
Oh my God! Do I have to? What do you mean? What? You're politicizing by asking that question. You are politicizing the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Am I violating his HIPAA rights?
You're violating the holiday. You don't discuss Dr. Martin Luther King in ways that are divisive. You know, you're bringing up that he was against the Vietnam War, that he was a pro-labor activist, for example, and that he wanted blacks and whites to unite in a worldwide struggle to end poverty. That's not how you honor his memory. You don't bring up the fact that he was leading a poor people's campaign. That's divisive. You politicize him by reminding people of who he really is. It's better to let people see whatever they want to see in Dr. King. That's how you honor his memory.
Wait. I feel like you just said two things that may contradict a little bit. You said you celebrate who he is, and then you say, but let everybody have their own idea of who he is.
Choice, freedom. Yes, that's what we do in this country. You see whatever you want in Dr. Martin Luther King. And when I watch your show, getting into his life on the granular level, it's divisive and it politicizes his memory. Tucker Carlson, you know Tucker Carlson?
Do I know him personally? No.
I don't agree with Tucker Carlson, but I was watching and he said Dr. King would oppose the teaching of critical race theory. And when I heard Tucker say that, I thought, we have come so far as a people where we're now a white man can see Dr. Martin Luther King and find anything he wants. And for you to say that Dr. King would be in favor of critical race thinking theory, or if you were to say Dr. King was a proponent of affirmative action, that you're politicizing his memory, and that's not what he wanted.
But David, when Tucker says that he would oppose critical race theory, is that politicizing Martin Luther King?
No, that's how far we've come as a nation, where we can all see. It's like a cloud. You want it to be a cloud. You see Dr. King is a cloud in the sky. What do you see? I see a bunny with 3 ears smoking a Mershon.
It's an Escher painting.
It's whatever you want to see. That's how far we've come as a nation. And again, the Shelby ruling, I was against it. The Roberts Court ruled that, you know, we're not the same way we were in the early 60s. But
Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Yes. Okay.
Yes. I was opposed to that ruling. But when I see Tucker Carlson saying that Dr. King would be against quotas and welfare, I think maybe the Roberts Court is right. Maybe the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65 worked.
So, and do you still believe that?
Believe what?
Well, Roberts wrote that in 2013.
That we don't need to put states, the old Confederacy.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what I do believe is we should not politicize voting. I think everyone should vote, but right now it's been politicized, and I find that offensive.
Well, politicized, and your definition of politicization seems a little weird to me. I mean, first off, the reason why we honor people is not because they're a good Rorschach test. Right. I mean, that would be, then we could just make up a holiday and just say, like, it's, I don't know, Feldman Day. Which Feldman? Doesn't really matter. You choose.
You're flattering me.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm talking about Tom Feldman. or Bill Feldman or Mary Feldman?
When you know that I'm a left, you know that I'm a lefty.
Yeah.
Right. But Martin Luther King Day, you forget how hard we struggled for Dr. Martin Luther King Day. You're too young to remember how hard it was to get it, like in Arizona. You have no idea how hard it was.
It was a very long time holdout. Yes.
Yeah. You have no idea the struggle for that holiday. And for you now to politicize it and be divisive.
Why was there a struggle for that holiday?
Because there are only 365 days in a calendar, Sam. Duh.
But why was it hard to get that holiday? Isn't that because...
Don't take this the wrong way, okay? I'm going to... Don't take this the wrong way. You Jews with your holidays. Don't take this the wrong way. But you, am I right? Emma, I don't want to get you in the middle of this, but everything's a holiday. The Jews and their holidays. My God. Well, why don't we just go from the Gregorian calendar to just the Sam Cedar calendar, where it's 365 days of holiday?
First off, I feel like you have aged like 35 years over the course of that sentence.
I have.
But you should also know that the Hebrew calendar.
Here we go. Yeah.
Existed, the Gregorian one.
The what calendar?
The Hebrew calendar.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We're in America now. Unpack.
This has nothing to do with the Jewish holiday.
Why are you playing the Jewish card now? I can't respond to that now. Anything I say now, you're going to take out of context, and I'm going to be accused of Jew baiting you. Jesus Christ! Oh, I'm sorry.
You could say Jesus Christ. That's fine. Listen, but here's the point, is that we were talking about why it's difficult to get a Martin Luther King holiday.
It was hard, and we struggled for it. And Emma and you are standing on the shoulders of my struggle, and then you use it to politicize it and bring up stuff.
Was it a struggle? That's what I'm asking you.
Because it's hard to get a holiday. It's hard.
Why was that your struggle, David?
Because I believed
aligned against it.
I believed in the holiday, but you don't talk. You don't taint his memory with specifics. You don't bring up the fact that he was against the Vietnam War and was a labor activist. That's divisive when you teach that. Then people don't want to celebrate the holiday. Let him be whatever you want him to be. And don't do what the Democrats did, using the holiday to pass a voting rights bill. My God. How to dishonor his memory by politicizing this week? By trying to tie his memory in with voting rights?
I mean, voting rights were a big, big struggle for him.
Voting rights.
Voting rights.
Yeah. And do you think that helps bringing that up? So you're saying you've poured over the FBI file on him, and you found out that he was for voting rights, and let's bring that up now.
Well, that's not. You don't have to pore over the FBI files to know that he was maybe the largest advocate, single individual associated with the push for the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, because the FBI was tapping his phones, and this is stuff. This is
politicizing it now, David.
No,
why are you bringing up the FBI?
Why am I bringing up the FBI?
Yeah.
Because you're using the files that they kept on him and violating his privacy.
I think I got you cornered.
What are you talking about?
Why would you talk about things that the evil J. Edgar Hoover dug up on him about voting rights and being a labor organizer and thinking about the least among us? That's not that's private stuff. You know, he's got grandchildren who might listen to the show. They don't need to know this stuff. He was a flawed human being, just like every man. We all have compromise.
The flaws are the support for voting rights and the labor activism.
You know, that's compromise. You're saying it's compromise.
Yes, and the FBI had no. The FBI had no
voting rights. You're saying it was compromise.
Yeah, the FBI had no business tapping his phone, you know, taping his hotel. Where, you know, when you get older, you will learn that human beings are flawed. And I have been in hotel rooms.
Oh God.
And I have said things that I didn't want other people to know. And for you now to take what I consider.
Oh, wait. Like what?
What have I said?
Yeah. And was Meatloaf there?
Yes. As a matter of fact, because he was there when I lost my virginity, and
of course, and how did you arrange that? How was that arranged? Was the fact that he was there a coincidental to your loss of your
meatloaf
circumstances?
It's Mr. Loaf.
Okay, was Mr. Loaf instrumental in the loss of your virginity, or was he incidental to the loss of your virginity? You just happened to be there.
I went to one of his concerts.
Okay.
And I was a virgin, and I came backstage, and I said, "Mr. Loaf," and he said, "Call me Meat." Okay. Mr. Loaf is my father's name. Call me Meat, okay. and my knees buckled, right. And he said, "You look like a virgin." And I said, I'm 33 years old, and this is one of the things that...
It was also your first concert.
It was my first concert.
Right.
And it was great. And he said, you know, a lot of men have lost their virginity listening to me. We'll get a hotel room. And he took me into a hotel room and helped me lose my virginity. And then I was ready for a woman. I don't know why.
David, you know, I really can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on a day where you're obviously clearly in mourning. You know, you're going through a rough patch right now. And it is to have you come on in this time where you're this vulnerable. And,
you know, it must be nice to sit in your bubble while the Democratic Party, while Biden is just being dragged down. Are you whiny leftists who are...
Wait, where is this coming from?
And I'm a leftist, but I'm not whiny. I'm an adult. And you are dragging this man down, and you don't accept the world as it is.
What are you talking about? We were just talking about... We've been talking about Meatloaf and MLK for half an hour.
Yeah, and you're dragging... I watched the show... Emma and Sam.
Okay.
And all you do is criticize Biden. It's all you do. And you know, you lost. You lost. You know, and now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of their party. You're dragging Biden down.
Is that a quote? Is that "all good men come to their party"? Is that a quote?
It's an MLK quote.
Oh, I didn't even know.
I believe it was. You know, this lurch to the left that you insist upon is what's dragging Biden down. That's why his poll numbers are so horrible. That's why we lost in Virginia the $15 minimum wage, the PRO Act, the Green New Deal, forgiving student loans, the public option for Obamacare. That stuff is dragging Biden down.
I see. I mean, I feel like you've changed your perspective suddenly on this whole thing. But you're arguing that he moved too far to the left, and that
he's lurched. He's I don't recognize the man. And
weren't all the things that you just mentioned part of his campaign platform?
Yes. And that's yes.
Okay. And didn't he win the election with that platform?
That he wanted those things. He wanted those things. Do you remember Playboy?
Playboy magazine?
Yeah. The centerfold would tell you her likes and dislikes, and then you would decide whether or not you wanted to dream about her.
So I'm not sure it was.
Maybe I'll be right back
on her likes. Yeah, this is a good time for Emma maybe to step out.
No, it's just you want to know likes and dislikes.
It wasn't the likes and dislikes.
That's how you vote.
That's how you vote. But you're talking. You're saying that
he's for the $15 minimum wage. Okay, that he likes that. So I like him. He's for the PRO Act. I like him.
But you said it was dragging him down.
Because when you, maybe you haven't used a dating app, you find out what somebody likes and dislikes. That should be enough. If you like Verde. That's interesting. I like Aaron Copland. You know, we can talk about opera, but I'm not going to say, oh, we have to go see this Aaron Copland concert. It's you want to know what these people like and dislike. Where did Emma go? Did she mad at me?
She didn't. I think she didn't want to hear about the Playboy stuff was making her uncomfortable.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She had to run. She had to take a quick break. Sometimes right. It gets a little bit intense with you, and sometimes people need a break.
All right. Why don't you give Joe Biden a break?
I think we've been very fair to Joe Biden.
Did you support Bernie?
I did, yeah.
So did I. I wanted Bernie. But okay. Now we need to get behind Biden. Because
I feel like we did get behind Biden.
You're pushing him off a cliff. But you're getting behind him and pushing him off a cliff.
What do you mean get behind him? What cliff?
You can't accept the results of 2020. I didn't want him, but I believe in the process. The process is I wanted Bernie, but in the primaries, Bernie started to win big, and Pete Buttigieg was winning big, and we all thought this is great. The system is working. The people are speaking. And then Barack Obama and Clyburn and Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, you know, they got to speak, and they said, no, it's going to be Biden, even though he was in last place. And to me, that was an inspiration that we should have embraced. The right man for the right time. Beto, Klobuchar, they endorsed Joe Biden. And Buttigieg, even though he had more delegates than Joe, he dropped out and got behind him. And I thought only in America is there this kind of upward mobility where a man, no delegates, was given got a helping hand and he became president of the United States. They gave him a helping hand. He had everything against him. Isn't that an inspiration, Emma?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me. I thought you love MLK so much, and I'm sorry to politicize, but Biden, you know, spoke at Strom Thurmond's funeral.
Strom Thurmond.
Mm-hmm.
You're bringing up my hair transplants. Is this trying to throw me off center? But Strom Thurmond had bad hair transplants. I have bad hair transplants. Is this what you're trying to do? You're trying to throw me off my game.
We didn't know either of those things.
I wasn't aware of hair transplants.
Okay. So did you know that Joe Biden has hair transplants?
Well, that's clear.
And did you know that Strom Thurmond had hair transplants?
No, I did not know that.
See? Okay. And did you know that I have hair transplants?
No idea.
And did you know that, did you know how you drive a Corvette and you see another Corvette driver on the street? So you honk at them?
Never had that experience.
Yeah.
Well, men who
you
have
do with hair. Yachts, right? Like with boats, yes. Too, with yachts.
Yes,
you're just like,
exactly.
Hey, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, of course.
Yeah, and so men with hair transplants, there's a bond. And that's why he spoke at Strom Thurmond's funeral.
And how come you did not?
And that's Joe Buck, coincidentally.
Joe Buck, yes. He did not have a good experience with his hair transplant. Why are you bringing this up? Why are you trying to throw me off my game?
David, we really do have to say goodbye now.
You guys.
Listen, I again want to just say, without you picking another random topic to attack us with, I appreciate you coming on this day that's very difficult in the wake of Meatloaf's passing away at such a vibrant time in his life.
Yes. I have to go lift weights now.
All right.
Because I'm going to be one of the pallbearers at Meatloaf's funeral.
David Feldman, always, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you now.
Are we done? Are we over? Or?
Yeah, we're saying
Emma, did I say something, Emma, that you that upset you?
You know, David, we're still on air.
Oh, okay. I just didn't want to say anything that...
You just sort of stopped talking after I said, yeah, I said goodbye. Yeah,
you made him cry, Sam.
I'm sorry.
No, I just don't want to say anything that is offensive.
It's a little bit late. You're a little bit late.
Well, you were the one who brought up.
I'm not just talking about today.
Well, I unlike you, I'm not divisive. And I want everybody to like me. I wake up and I think, what can I do today? So people will not know.
You know what I think you should do? The first thing, maybe take a course on it, because you're not good at it. You're very good.
I'm teaching a course on it. It's kind of like taking a course on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at likability.
David Feldman.
Are we done yet?
I can't thank you enough for coming on today.
This is like what the FBI does. You tricked me. This is like me in a hotel room being videotaped.
David Feldman, thank you so much for coming on today.
No privacy whatsoever. No privacy. This was a violation of my Fourth Amendment rights.
Appreciate your coming on today.
Bye-bye.
Wow. That was something.
He seems very upset.
He seems very upset. Maybe we should have checked on him before we had him on. I mean, that was pretty stunning. Folks, we're going to head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. I don't know if we'll have time for calls today, but we're certainly going to take your IMs. You can get the app at Majority App. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. That and the sponsor support that we have from Sunset Lake Sebade today. Check out those tinctures, the mint and the citrus, and also the new size of the tincture. Definitely worth your while to check them out. Great company, as you know. Also, you can find out exactly what's in there by looking at their third-party certification on their website. It's actually pretty cool to see all the different things that are in there. You can also support this program by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
Yeah, Wednesday night we did a marathon show, almost just short of 5 hours with Ben Burgess on his new Christopher Hitchens book, including 3 hours of postgame. So patreon.com/leftreckoning if you want to get access to that this weekend for patrons. David and I will be starting our Karl Marx reading group from the beginning with his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right. That's the opiate of the masses quote. We'll be breaking that down and putting that in context. So patreon.com/leftreckoning for that stuff.
Okay, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.